display hundreds of combinations. It all depended on what information we fed the system and what we wanted. The system helped us manage the data, providing a capability of real-time visualization. We could glance at the electronic map and immediately know the situation. This made our command decisions easier. I started checking the map early every morning, often throughout the day and night. The magic box, as we did start calling it, was better than I could have ever imagined. On Sunday, 7 October, the bombing campaign started, and the system was put to an extreme test. During the campaign, not one incident of fratricide occurred. Despite numerous occasions when our teams or individual Afghan agents were at or near targeted areas just prior to airstrikes, all survived. On one occasion, a B-2 approached its primary target, but we had lost communication with our Afghan source and could not confirm that he had vacated the area. U.S. Air Force General Mike Buzz Mosley and his team, which included a CIA representative, ran the air campaign from their command center in a Persian Gulf country. We alerted General Mosley's command to our problem and requested they abort the mission. His team immediately diverted the B-2. Buzz and his team, especially the pilots, performed magnificently. They hit enemy targets with precision. They avoided no-strike zones with equal skill. They were responsible, demanding intelligence customers and eager combat partners. On another occasion, while Dan and Ken sat in one of the two-a-day video conferences with CENTCOM, our military partners inquired if we had a CIA team on the road south of Baghlan. Ken always took his GIS-loaded laptop to these conferences. The latest data showed that there were no teams, agents, or allies anywhere in that area. CENTCOM, which included General Mosley's command, explained that F-16s were pursuing a possible enemy convoy. Ken and Dan gave the all clear. The F-16s attacked. Just days prior to the first U.S. military operation in the South, near Kandahar on 19 and 20 October, the Special Operations Force, SOF, liaison officer assigned to CTC-SO, asked Ken for any information on that area. We had just acquired some GIS data on minefields in Afghanistan. Ken called the office, captured the data on our magic box, and provided it to our military customer. The U.S. commandos now had maps with the most current minefield data. I asked Dan and Ken to brief Director Tenet. The briefing was scheduled for 10 minutes, but lasted an hour. With his laptop, Ken demonstrated example after example of how the system worked. In the coming weeks, military and congressional leaders demanded briefings about the magic box. I would even use maps printed from the system to brief the president and others about our operations. As the operations grew in both scope and complexity, so did the team working in our targeting branch. From 2 desktop computers and a laptop used by Ken and 3 other officers, the system expanded to a network of desktops, a printer and plotter, and a flat screen for group briefings that showed the updates from the previous night, the locations of our teams, military operations, and key enemy locations. I instructed that we pipe the EMAP data to CENTCOM so they would have the same GIS view that we had. Dan and Ken worked to integrate the intelligence community into our targeting operations. As an example, each day NSA provided CTC-SO specific geo-coordinates of targets. Ken's team, however, spent hours reformatting the data for ingestion into our GIS. One of Ken's officers created a script that could pull the data out of the reports if only NSA would change its format. Ken invited the NSA team to CTC-SO for a briefing. He explained to the visitors how we used their data and how we labored to fit the data into our system. He proposed that NSA reformat their reports to meet our needs. The visiting NSA managers and analysts immediately agreed. The next morning, Ken's team incorporated the reformatted NSA data into our GIS in minutes instead of hours. CTCSO also created a system to share this data in the field, even creating a replica of our EMAP in Kabul Station. In January 2002, with growing demand for our intelligence downrange, Ken traveled to Afghanistan to set up the same GIS for our military customers. Eventually, Ken and his team would teach individual field officers how to utilize the deployed GIS laptops. CTCSO loaded each laptop with the large base layer of data files and would transmit updated data layers as the information changed. This data allowed each base, team, or even individual officer to have the same view of the battlefield as HQS, making operational planning much more coherent and interactive. Dan and Ken would later find 3D graphic software that would project on a screen Afghanistan terrain. We would virtually fly into this battle space, twisting and turning as we observed every trail and creek and ridge. The experience was really weird and supremely helpful. This dynamic image, combined with precise imagery, enabled a new perspective of war for the CIA, military, and policymakers. We created the magic box for our own use and that of our customers. This acute awareness of customer needs is what makes the CIA different from other intelligence agencies. Others only collect for their own missions. The FBI works to acquire evidence to prosecute a case. The DIA seeks to fill military requirements. The CIA, on the other hand, collects and analyzes for a range of customers, from the president to the diplomat to the soldier. The CIA's hardwired imperative to serve customers, combined with a mix of inspired talent like Dan and Ken, compelled CTCSO to experiment and innovate. Geospatial intelligence collection, analysis, and dissemination would never be the same. Neither would war. Networked Command. Our campaign in Afghanistan was unusual, however, because we were both a principal collector and a principal customer. With their monumental covert action role, the teams were consuming intelligence for their own use. It was completely unprecedented for the CIA to take the lead in collecting intelligence, analyzing the product, producing a strategy, and then implementing covert action as the pointy end of statecraft and war. We understood that supporting the teams downrange required not just material and political support, but also intelligence. We pushed as much intelligence to them as we could, and we encouraged them to share with each other. Due to this dynamic lateral communication, the teams often could respond more quickly and effectively, sometimes before we in HQS even know what action they were taking. This was more than okay. It was what I wanted. The field leaders demonstrated flat, networked intelligence collaboration and covert action at its best. In one example, the leader of Team Alpha, near Mazar-e-Sharif, called to inquire about HQS's inability to insert a team with the Hazara tribes in central Afghanistan. Our only communication to these Afghan allies was relayed via open telephone calls through a switch in Uzbekistan. The big problem? We had no knowledge of potential landing zones in Bamiyan province. We did not know where we could insert our team. Nor did we have high confidence in the Hazara's ability to hold off the Taliban while we dropped a team among them. We were stuck. Alpha team leader, however, volunteered to deploy two of his men overland via a truck through some of the most formidable country in Afghanistan. The journey would take 36 hours. I told him to do it. Obviously, he had been communicating with other team leaders and understood our strategic need to place a team there in Bamiyan, to the west of Kabul, so we could recruit local allies and drive to the capital while the Jawbreaker team in the Panjshir would break across the Somali plains and attack Kabul from the north. This team leader, because we had been sharing our intelligence and our strategic intent to all the teams, understood the greater need and responded. He deployed the two officers, including Mike Spann, who would be killed in combat a few weeks later. After a tortuous truck ride over the central mountains, navigating through a mishmash of tribal alliances, the two operatives made contact with Hazara leader Khalili. He accepted them warmly and provided security and recon teams to help them. The two officers scouted a landing zone, LZ, and established defensive protocols for the insertion. Days later, the joint CIA-SF team landed, securing a toehold in central Afghanistan and expanding our intelligence collection. Initial victory would unfold faster than any of us anticipated. It was because of the flat chain of command